Ladies and gentlemen, we'll start the panel in, and I'll invite you to sit down. Thank you.
There must be a lineup for coffee out there. Can I encourage you all to sit down, please, and we're going to get the second panel underway. I mentioned at the outset that risk capital takes two forms, and the first panel was on angel financing, which typically comes earlier in the stage of the firm. But much of the attention in the media and in policy really focuses on the other kind of risk capital, namely venture capital financing. And to help us think through some of the issues on that today, again, in keeping with my policy of not reading biographies, we have an extremely talented panel with a huge amount of experience and expertise in this topic. Moderating the panel is Jerome Nyes. Jerome is the Vice President of Corporate Planning of Business Development Bank, and as the Business Development Bank goes through its 10-yearly legislative review, part of his interest and the interest of his team is how do we create in Canada a venture capital infrastructure that works better than the one that we now have. And Jerome comes at this with many years of experience and really has a good take on the venture capital landscape in Canada. To help him explore this, we have Richard Bradlow. Richard is a partner in Penn Fund. Harvard-educated, one of Penn Fund's investments is something that I have an almost daily relationship with. That investment is Good Life Fitness, and I think probably one of the winners in that portfolio. I encountered Richard a few months ago at a Toronto Society of Financial Analysts event where he was speaking about, with very little preparation, whether or not Canada needs more venture capital. And I look forward to what he has to say to us today. Gordon Murray. Gordon Murray's bio is in your package. The one thing I want to point out about Gordon is that one of the things he does or has done every year, I'm not sure he's going to do it this year, is Gordon organizes a conference somewhere in Europe to which he invites policymakers from last year 18 to 20 countries, I'm not sure the exact count, a sprinkling of academics whose research has to do with public policy. And almost every year, the question before the House is, what can governments do to help stimulate venture capital? And other questions as well. But a closed door, you show me yours, I'll show you mine, exchange of what's worked and what hasn't worked. Very effective, very popular, very useful seminar. Jan Peters. He and I were classmates. Yes, I know I look much younger. We were classmates here at McGill in engineering back around the turn of the 70s. Jan in mining engineering and me in metallurgy. And we may have played against each other in football, I'm not sure. But since then, Jan has gone on to look at venture capital from both sides, as a venture capitalist, as a business owner, entrepreneur, and a successful one at that. So with that much introduction, I'll turn this over to Jerome, who will moderate the panel, and he'll explain the way in which this panel will work.
Thank you, Alan. We'll be going through this exercise in a different section. Panelists will have 3 to 4 minutes to present an opening statement. Panel discussion fed with a number of questions. I'll take questions from the floor, and then I'll ask my panelists to do a 2-minute wrap-up to summarize their take on the panel discussion. So to introduce the topic, as Alan mentioned, BDC is very active in the venture capital market. We invest both directly and indirectly, and we have relationship with most LPs. We strongly believe that in ensuring a vibrant and self-sustaining VC ecosystem, we need to stimulate institutional investment. Based on work that we've done recently, the way we see the venture capital market as an ecosystem, talented entrepreneur and management start with high potential companies. Skilled VC and angel fund, the best companies. Best company grows through additional financing and VC board support. Active exit option brings strong returns. Sophisticated profit-seeking investor allocate appropriate capital to the VC asset class. All must be supported by a vibrant VC infrastructure. In reality, in Canada, while we call this a virtuous circle, we might be witnessing a vicious circle. So the question today is, you know, two governing questions. Is, does Canada really need more venture capital? Do we need more money? Or are the real issue more structural in nature? Second governing question, what is government role in respect to venture capital sector? Should it be more active or should it be less involved? Now I'd like to turn to the floor, to my panelists, and we'll start with Richard Bradlow with the 2-minute, 3-minute opening statement. Richard?
Thank you. Do you want me to use the microphone?
Sure. Or do you want to, come
here? Okay.
Good morning. My name is Richard Bradlow. I'm a partner at Penn Fund, and just to give you very quickly some perspective on what I do and where my views come from, Penn Fund is a manager of about $300 million, which comes from pension funds and life insurance companies and high net worth families in Canada. We make investments of $10 to $50 million in mid-stage and later-stage companies, primarily in Canada, but also in the United States. Some of the companies we've invested in that you may be familiar with are CanGrow, which owns the Del Monte and Aylmer brands in Canada. It's a food company. Wakefield, which is an exclusive distributor of Castrol Motor Oil in Canada. And Good Life Fitness Centers, which in Quebec operates under a few banners, including VitaV. My experience with venture capital is threefold. Prior to joining Penn Fund, I worked as an investment banker raising money for early-stage companies, most of them technology-oriented. While at school, I wrote a research paper on the labor-sponsored fund industry primarily in Ontario, and I'm actively involved in the venture capital and private equity industry broadly defined. So on the question of whether there's a shortage of venture capital in Canada, I would describe conventional wisdom as something along the following lines. Returns have been abysmal because venture capital firms haven't had enough money to properly fund businesses from inception to IPO or sale. As a result of poor returns earned by venture capitalists, the pool of capital is shrinking, and companies that could be the next RIM are not getting funded. The evidence that there's a shortage is primarily that that venture capital investment per capita or in relation to GDP is lower in Canada than in the United States. And the prescription is usually some variation on governments should directly or indirectly fix the problem and justify the cost of the fix on the basis that they'll be fostering innovation, entrepreneurialism, or a knowledge-based economy. I believe the reality is actually quite different. I believe there's been a significant oversupply of venture capital relative to the number of quality early-stage companies in Canada. I believe the source of the poor returns has been too much capital chasing too few opportunities. A secondary source of the poor returns is that our pool of venture capitalists in Canada is distinctly mediocre, and I'll explain that further a little later. Much of the oversupply and the resulting distortion of a natural supply of venture capital in relation to opportunities has been due to labor funds. In my view, these have been an investment scandal. The investment managers have grown extremely wealthy, irrespective of the fact that they produced abysmal returns. The money was raised by paying unusually high commissions to brokers to raise the money from unsophisticated retail investors who had no real comprehension of what they were investing in. And even net of the tax effects, these retail investors generally suffered losses or no return at all. The entire venture industry has had negative returns, as other people have cited, on a 1, 3, 5, and 10-year basis. Labor funds were about, at their peak, roughly a third of the pool of capital in Canada. And as governments have ended these programs and that pool is drying up, the resulting reduction in supply should be very good for the industry in that it will allow independent venture capitalists to hopefully earn better returns due to less competition. But the supply side is only half the issue. I think there are several structural reasons why Canada is not positioned to have a growing, vibrant venture community anywhere on par with the United States. Some of these structural reasons include our higher taxes, more regulation, smaller domestic markets, no university equivalents of MIT, Stanford, or Harvard, no network effects that exist in communities like Boston or Silicon Valley with deep pools of financial, HR, IT, consulting, and managerial talent that exist to support startups. We have a less mobile labor force, we have a more conservative culture, and we have shallow industry verticals. And it's these shallow industry verticals that I believe is the primary reason our venture capitalists themselves are mediocre. The typical U.S. venture capitalist will spend their entire career doing nothing but CRM software deals or chip deals and will develop significant sectoral expertise. The venture capitalists in Canada that I've met, for the most part, are generalists. They'll go and do a software deal, then a chip deal, then an internet deal. And in venture capital, unlike, say, the buyout space, understanding the technology and the sector is critically important because they're evolving much more rapidly. Being a generalist doesn't work. And it ties into the fact that if you come up with a terrific idea for a startup, who would you rather want as your investor, a sectoral specialist from the United States who's done nothing but work in that sector, or a Canadian generalist? Just a couple of final points, and I'll turn it over to one of my co-panelists. I don't think that a shrinking industry is of particular public policy concern. The border is becoming less and less relevant to finance across all asset classes. And any worthwhile Canadian startup, if they can't raise money in Canada, can just as easily raise it in the United States. Withholding taxes, other barriers to cross-border finance are rapidly disappearing. From the perspective of the Canadian economy, provided we have access to the products and services that result from these startups, and we do through free trade, what is the real consequence of foreign investors financing our startups? We often hear the argument that Canada will turn into an empty shell, but I think these are the views primarily of economic nationalists, and I don't think can be substantiated in any other way. I would certainly love to have Waterloo turn into Silicon Valley, but I think the structural reasons I referred to before make that very unlikely. So, final 2 points. The alarm bells I hear from my perch about the state of the industry come primarily from the fund managers who've seen their incomes compress as the industry has shrunk. It's not from companies who can't get funding. And in my view, the best government can do is get out of the way by reducing taxes, reducing regulatory inhibitions, and by not creating a situation where, through their policies, they direct a dollar towards the venture capital industry, which comes at the expense of a dollar going to more mature or later stage businesses. The pool of capital is finite, and it alarms me when people would make decisions like that, would come up with policies and programs which distort capital markets and ignore the indirect costs of capital allocation to the venture industry. I'll stop there and turn it over to one of my colleagues.
Thank you. I'll ask Jan Peters to take over if you want the podium.
I That was depressing, wasn't it? My name is Jan Peters. I guess I am one of the entrepreneurs here, and I don't think there are too many. In fact, I want to ask the question. If you would raise your hands, any one of you who works for a company which you founded. Not bad. Not bad. Okay, so that's a higher number than I was expecting from what I saw on the sheet. Because in point of fact, it's more about doing than talking. I'll give sort of my overview here. I started out working a decade in the engineering business. SNC took them public in 86, and I had a half a dozen ideas there that I wanted to pursue. A company in the rare earths business that I wanted to create, because I saw there's some opportunities creating there. That's obvious now with China. Some technologies related to electrochemistry, which I thought were interesting and need to be pursued. A couple of things in fiber optics, one in terms of networks, one in terms of switching. And then some opportunities as well in terms of surfactants and their application towards how these things could be used to in a whole bunch of applications in various chemical industries. So a real fruit salad of things, and there's no way that an engineering company that wants to get paid so many dollars per draftsman at a drafting board was going to put capital into those things. So I left and formed a small seed capital company to pursue them all. Now, they were all, to one extent or another, my notions. Each one of these things had about $5,000, $10,000 put into them, business plans written, try to find some guys, get things going. Hopefully one of those things would turn into something. And they did. Eventually we sold our various businesses for just over $2 billion and gave to the investors all in a rate of return of a little close to 60% compounded over 12 years. But that was because of luck, right timing and all sorts of things. It could have been half that. Still, the fundamental problem with venture capital, I think, is not the absence of capital, it's the absence of returns. If you have the returns, there is not a pension fund in Canada that isn't dying to invest in something that gives them returns. But it's very difficult for pension funds to invest in deals. Our last speaker was speaking about doing mid-stage and so on. Early stage, put down $5,000 and spend 5 years proving the concept before you raise money, is not something large institutions can invest in. So there's some structural issues there. We might ask the question about R&D. Do we do enough R&D? The answer is certainly in the Canadian context, we do as much as, say, Boston or, say, Silicon Valley as a percentage of our respective GDPs, roughly speaking. But, you know, the debate is it R or is it D? I can tell you from having started up and funded a thing called Inovia, which does startup and seed capital funding here in Montreal. It was a McGill thing. I was on the board at the time. That what comes out of the research that is done in the academic environment, even though there's $1 billion on this island alone that gets done of research, doesn't translate easily, is way, way, way removed from something that you can actually put real material amounts of money, a couple of $1 million, $5 million in the startup. It's just so far removed from that. So there are challenges with deal sizes. Pensions cannot put money into things that are less than $10 million, and $10 million is way too much to put in an early stage idea. You have to have some way of putting in small amounts of money, using it to eliminate the bulk of the risk, focusing on the business opportunity and getting it going. We have a culture in the private equity and the venture capital business, and you know, since I started up a company in that area, I think I can speak from both sides of that fence, where it's formulaic. We're going to draw down monies from a bunch of institutions over 5 years. We are then going to commercialize or sell off the investments we've made over the next 5 years, so it's 10 years. 2% per annum for managing the thing, 20% override on profits. What happens if it takes 7 years to have a proof of concept on something? It doesn't work. Those formulas are nice and cute. They happen to work very well for a couple of stellar enterprises based in Silicon Valley, but they don't generically work. The stuff that I did in my youth was, frankly, just a closed-end company that did a bunch of investments and eventually was able to sell them. So there are some structural issues with the way we approach it. But shortage of money is not the problem. Shortage of entrepreneurs is the problem. And that is something which I think our culture in our university, particularly our teaching environments, could go farther in encouraging the people who are in the classroom to actually want to start a business. You know, Michael Dell didn't wait to graduate to start a business. Neither did Bill Gates. And that's what you'd like to see with people who really believe in entrepreneurship as the road for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Gordon, if you want to join us.
Okay. Can I talk from here? Can you hear me? No? Oh, no, it's like karaoke.
It's a lift.
Right. Thank you for the invitation. I suppose the first thing I would say is I hear your pain. I'm surprised they allowed you to have ties, belts and shoelaces before you came in the room. If it's any consolation, I could be in Finland, Australia, Germany, England, France, and I would be hearing almost exactly the same conversations, sometimes with better wine, sometimes without. So what we have is a generic problem around the financing of attractive innovation for world-class products and services, and it's that stress on world-class products and services. We have a major conundrum in that the demand for technology and new knowledge and enhanced products and services continues to grow dramatically. And at the same time, as everyone has said, the returns to early stage investment are disastrous. Even pre the meltdown in 2000 and from 2002 onwards in the UK, the returns are still not comparable to the level of risk that is incurred. So it is without question rational to see this decline in early stage investment. Yesterday I gave a lecture and I showed a slide of a congregation of early stage venture capitalists. What I did was I showed a slide of the Gobi Desert. No life seen at all. And we have exactly that problem in the UK. We have seen a major decline in early stage investments. They either go to later stage investment or they go to private equity and buy-ins and buy-outs. So we have an industry that has been hollowed out. In these circumstances, does government have a role? Whether you agree or not, no government, no polity is going to believe it does not have a role. Personally, I believe it does, but it has to be a thought-out, rational role. For example, I think there is a profound role for government in changing the environment. That includes appropriate incentives, not pork-barreling by fatuous venture capital schemes. It also includes providing activities to enhance the culture. I mean, one of the things in the UK, perhaps unlike Canada, we have had three prime ministers who are four square behind the importance of entrepreneurship to the future of the British economy. Tony Blair can be criticised for many things, but he was in love with America. And in being in love with America, as was Gordon Brown, entrepreneurship was central to economic policy in the UK. I'm amazed when I hear that entrepreneurship is a relatively limited activity at universities. We have seen in the UK entrepreneurship being one of the most successful areas for student uptake, whether they're engineers, biologists, social scientists, English students, or whatever. Just let me end on saying government has to be more clever. What I see very often is government trying to engage in venture capital with a level of knowledge, with a level of experience, and with a level of analysis which is derisively poor. If you are going to engage in this area, you need to know what you're doing. And again, it's rare for me to support the British government, but we have what's called an enterprise capital policy program, and we actually have a capital for enterprise board, which are specialists that are from industry involved in working with government and with the BBCA and the industry in actually trying to design and experiment for systems and programs that are actually successful. Finally, two more points. If the government's involved in this, it's got to be involved in the long game. The development of an effective American venture capital industry was a 30-40 year play, not 2 years or one government program or one political administration. The other thing is government has got to be courageous. What I've heard today is a regional program. States, regions are talking about X and Y, their interests and so on. We have a problem in that in the regions of the UK, if we look at technology and innovation, we will probably have one winner: Oxford, Cambridge, and London. That has the potential, and in many cases is world class. Most of the rest of the UK isn't and will not be. And it's not the place we should be wasting scarce dollars if we are seriously interested in innovation. If we're interested in social policy and regional policy, of course we invest. And what I see time and time again is a compromise where government invests for political reasons because it is appropriate and politically sensible. This is nothing to do with innovation policy. And so I would end by saying really that if we're going to do this, we have got to have high-quality data, high-quality analysis. Last aside, 47% returns to business angels, I heard someone mention. I don't believe that for one second. That I just do not believe. I'm sorry. And we have to use that data to follow policies that are going to be effective. That is going to be very bloody, and a lot of people ain't going to like it. Thank you.
Thank you, Murray. Money is not a problem. We've heard that oversupply, not enough money. How do you define the appropriate level of funding in the market? Do you benchmark from previous year, or do you make relationship to business creation, entrepreneurship culture? When I look at numbers in 2001, percentage of VC-type funding and public market funding for what we consider VC-eligible company, healthcare and technologies company, 8%. In the U.S., 6%. Now that trend seems to have reversed to a deficit, so that's an oversupply of 31% in Canada. So too much money in Canada, early 2000. Now that trend has reversed to a deficit of 15%. So how, you know, in policy, when you look at public funding and research funding, how do you strike the equilibrium or a good balance for the industry, so there's a good supply and then there's a good return? I'll turn to any one of you to pick up that question.
My view on the supply side is that it shouldn't be measured on a Canadian basis, that it's a continental market, if not global, and that only the market can determine the right amount of capital, and it'll be returns driven.
I suppose I'm less confident that it's a global market. I think you need a clear cadre of highly trained venture capitalists, highly experienced in the deals, the legal structures, et cetera, and you need clearly a high quality supply of entrepreneurs. In those circumstances, what we're finding at the moment is that basically the early stage has been left by the industry, while acknowledging that it's important and it needs to be there because it's their future deal flow. In those cases, I think there is an argument, there's a structural problem where government can be a provider of equity as a special limited partner. What I would not say is that government should ever be involved as the direct investor allocating investments. But I think if you leave it to a global market for America to come in, I'm concerned that in one sense there will be some element of hollowing out. It may be good returns to certain investors and certain institutions. I'm not sure it's a long-run benefit of Canada or indeed Britain.
Perhaps I'm not qualified too much to speak on the global perspective. I can speak in terms of the funds that exist at Inovia a little bit. We have two basic thrusts, life sciences and what I'll call technologies that are very much web-related or those kinds of technology-related. Often what happens is we find ourselves on the tech side looking at a North American perspective, not a Canadian perspective. So we recently took a company out of Edmonton that was doing some stuff that was going to take advantage of the way advertising dollars are flowing differently given Internet products. And frankly, we took one of our partners who's based out of New York, almost literally on Madison Avenue, to reorganize what was a great technology but needed to have access to the content providers that needed this product. When we are doing things in the biological sciences, we don't actually go south of the border looking for the expertise or the depth of money or the talent to sit on the board. There, very often, it is a European talent because we find it there and a willingness to invest that we find less in North America. In fact, in the biological sciences, I find people are very scared because it's like 15 years before you know whether you're going to have a product or not, with the decision being taken on the last day. So those things kind of vary.
Next, is VC an effective tool to build technology firm? If I look at our experience, the four hormones we had a minimum 6 years in our book and going up to 10 years. Now, if I apply a standard VC model, GP, 2% management fee, 20% carry, 10 years fund structure. So, if average size, you know, 80 million in Canada, can I build a successful technology firm with that model? Is the model of fund structure still effective to build technology firms?
My only comment would be I don't think the fund structure itself is a huge obstacle. I think it's the people working within the funds. I think what's more central is whether they have relevant experience to whatever the project of the startup is. And For the reasons I cited before related to the nature of our industry verticals, more often than not, in my experience, that is not the case.
Again, my experience is not worldwide, but to take the first fund we created in the Inovia context was because the government wanted to have seed capital coming out of the research monies that were going into universities. So we put together a bunch of universities, and they were getting matching funds from the government, and I arranged to arrange the funds for the universities. What came out of the universities on what was a 10-year structure, exactly the way you described it, is for the first 5 years we had almost no deals that were worthy of putting in a material amount of money, or if we did put in a material amount of money, we had to do some course corrections that were non-trivial before we put in subsequent amounts of money. And we ended up creating sort of an incubator beast. I don't like the word incubator, but still it is that. Valorization is the term here in Quebec. Beast that would take the stuff raw out of the universities and frankly 5 to 7 years before you found that, okay, now we're ready to put in $2 to $5 million. That process is missing in the equation. So how does a VC fund do that? A VC fund that's got 5 years to place $100 million can't start diddling around with 50,000, 100,000, 500,000 exploration initiatives that are actually going to be worthy of 5 million 7 years from now. The clock ran out. So I think there are some structural issues, and I don't know that the VC fund structure is the problem, but there is that who does startup funding. In the case of Inova, we sort of ended up taxing ourselves, the partners ended up taxing themselves, so that they would continue funding this incubator beast so that at least 20% of our deals going forward would probably come out of universities, but typically 7 years after we first looked at them.
Yeah, I think there is a structural problem. I think that the model of 10 years closed-end funds, we know that actually the life cycle of young firms is lengthening. Certainly in biotech, it's not even conceivable to do that. So I think you said that we have a model that is based on one or two stellar Silicon Valley examples.
Yes. Yes.
And they are the exception in virtually everything. And so it seems to me that in many ways, one, venture capital needs to be looked at rigorously. I mean, you mentioned that we should have perhaps less competition and we'd get better returns. I've been in venture capital for 20 years. I don't think I've ever seen any competition between venture capitalists worth speaking about. We have a fee structure that has been obscenely attractive to venture capitalists with damn output
to the recipients and users, be they the limited partners or young firms. The sooner that collapses, the better in many ways. We also see a situation where governments see venture capital as an answer to a maiden's prayer. Well, you know, we are talking about a tiny minority of businesses, and many of those businesses are highly attractive, highly successful. They will not make IRRs of 60-70%, but are still very valuable to the economy. And we have a very good example. Germany is based on that kind of logic, you know, a diversity of activities, with venture capital being one part of it. Another thing that's not often said, we did quite a large study recently. If you get venture capital business angel finance in the UK or Germany, it only increases your death rate by about 6 to 7%. It does increase your opportunity for growth. So I think we do actually need to look at the venture capital model. And I do think we need to get the industry to honestly be part of that discussion, because the British industry until 2 years ago used to talk PR whenever it met anyone. It did not tell the truth, and it actually suffered really rather badly as a result of that, because the government lost patience. What we need to do is to look at this industry and see what part venture capital should play, and particularly in relation to business angels and self-financing. At the moment, we still haven't got that right. And one of the key things is how, like SBIR and others, how do we fund that early stage before they should ever approach venture capitalists? And I think the government has kind of left that to the market, and the market quite rightly has said, this is not something we can make money on, given the levels of risk. And so I see the government having a role at this very early stage of pre-commercialization activity, rather than saying, well, you know, let's play Darwin.
All right, thank you. When we look at the numbers of funds in Canada, maybe the top decile are making money. The rest are not generating very, very strong returns. Now, there'll be a rationalization. Well, there is a net rationalization of the ecosystem and the GP participant. Now, their likelihood to be able to raise other funds if they have negative returns are limited. Now, how do you get the LPs back in the game? Do you need incentive schemes? And some, I know some other jurisdictions have looked at incentive in either downside protection to reduce the risk or upside participation to reward success. How do we get the LPs back in the game? And how long do you think it's going to take for the market to stabilize, to have returns that would make it attractive without any intervention?
Well, we have a dozen LPs in our firm, and I would say that they're a very sophisticated, experienced group. And if they've concluded that they can't make money investing in the asset, I'm not sure there's much I can say to dissuade them. I'm not sure I have different information or different approaches that they can use. I think it's an informed view. You know, secondly, if you're a pensioner whose money's being managed by one of these pension funds, do you want the pension fund investing in something that's partially justified on an abstract public policy goal rather than pure return? I personally wouldn't. And if that's the case, if you know, if you're doomed to basically lose money on it and you're turning to government at the end of the day to absorb the loss, well, you know, I think the government's intermediate role just blurs the issue. If we went around this room and asked everyone to write a check for $1,000 to fund a vehicle with the ideal structure that we could come out with, I don't think as an individual you would want to do that. So why, if government's doing it, is it better for society, from a public policy point of view, for the economy? It's a bad investment decision.
It's far from me to disagree. The government has a different set of interests. It hasn't got exclusive the same interests as an LP, whether it's an insurance fund or a pension fund, and that has to be recognized. If we say in Britain, okay, we have seen a catastrophic decline in early-stage startup venture capital. Life's tough. Let's do something else. That is not tenable and shouldn't be tenable. First of all, it wastes enormous R&D dollars spent on sophisticated world-class technology with a high level of opportunity. So I think in modern sophisticated Western economies, we have to retain innovative capability. And in some cases, that means spending federal dollars, as the US has done for years, as China is doing hugely, as we're doing. What it means is that we do not ask LPs to make silly decisions, which they won't. You know, they quite rightly ignore it. What we have to do is to look at, in some cases, for the government where it can intervene in an effective way. And we had the SBIC, which had a variable history in the US, but what we have seen is a number of countries using equity enhancement or hybrid venture capital schemes, where the government becomes usually a significant partner and requires lower returns than the private partners. And we know from our research across a number of countries that that can give an uprise of about 9% to the portfolio. So that can actually make it attractive for a number of investors to invest in appropriately structured and appropriately managed venture capital funds. But what the government shouldn't do is, one, replace an industry which has got very many clever men and women doing, you know, of huge skills in investing. And I agree entirely about this of, you know, generalizers as opposed to specialists. And secondly, it should not set up facilely stupid small venture capital operations, undercapitalized, undermanaged, underfocused, and say, well, I know it's not very good, but at least it's in Yorkshire. And we do that all the time.
I'm not gonna reply to that. I think that's
all right. It's $11 billion being spent in research and development in Canada public funding. Now, if I think there's been one tech IPO in the last 3 years. Is that that's a pretty significant funnel? Should we be concerned about that? Because the alternative is failure, or the alternative is M&A being purchased by another company, most likely a foreign company. So if there's no role of government in that ecosystem, then should we be worried as taxpayers that there's that type of triage being done? And if I look south of the border, the land of free market, was there a role the U.S. government played in making sure that there was an ecosystem conducive to developing technology firms?
Since I'm holding the mic, you talked about the IPO markets. Well, the IPO markets, you know, since the dot-com crash have kind of disappeared. Anybody who's funding a company today in a new technology is figuring out, okay, I'm going to have to fund this thing, or at least the people who are shareholders are going to have to fund this thing all the way through to break even so that you have an opportunity to do it. The idea of having something which has got interesting technology, zero revenues or negative cash burn, and that's when you're going to sell it, is pretty rare. Now, I'm on the board of a semiconductor company in California, and I break every one of those rules. We buy companies quite often that are at their threshold. But that's semiconductor, and that's California. It's not the world in general. I don't know whether the IPO market can come back. I kind of doubt it. It's become very expensive to take companies public, incredibly expensive compared to what it was a few years ago. In fact, half the acquisitions we do is because we eliminate the cost of a public listing from a company. That's the big synergy in buying the company, which does not augur well for relying on IPO markets to take, you know, to create your exit. So the exit is primarily an M&A type exit, and as you said, you know, the nature of the beast is that you're going to sell to the bigger entity, and the bigger entity might be an American company, it might be a mining company in Australia. It is unlikely to be in this particular village. I know this isn't venture capital in the traditional sense. My background originally was in mining and mining engineering. In Canada, we do $2-3 billion a year of funding to go drill moose pasture in Mongolia. And there's a whole structure for doing that, including public listings and everything else. And if you think that isn't risk capital, by God, that's risk capital. That is in our bones here in Canada. We do that easily. In fact, years ago, I helped set up a Canadian Mineral Partnership, which was doing $1 billion a year of that kind of financing for those kind of. Now, there used to be drilling tax credits and this sort of thing, but the point was that was an industry that somehow was in the bones of the Canadian financial community. When you go to Bay Street or House Street and you try to have that discussion about technology with the same kinds of brokerage firms, they just sort of like want you out of the door. They don't even want to imagine it. So we have to fund things here right through to break even, which means that we have the problem is that the break even might revolve $10 million worth of investment if you're lucky with your plan, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, you should figure out how to spend $100,000 to eliminate as much risk as you can with a small amount of money, and institutions can't make $100,000 investments. They can't afford to even think about making $100,000. So we do have a dilemma which doesn't seem to exist in say, the mining sector, but does in technology.
It goes back to sort of demand side. I mean, the lack of IPOs is fundamentally about the lack of economic opportunities coming onto markets, whatever they may be. So in one sense, it is a result rather than or a consequence of the present structure and lack of attractive opportunities rather than a problem in itself. Just in case you think I'm totally in love with government, the British government at the moment has also realised the problem with IPOs, and one of our beloved ministers has suggested that we should resolve this by having a number of regional stock markets. So we're going to reverse 200 years pattern and go the other way. So I would say one has to be careful about the ideas of government, particularly if they are unsupported or, in this case, just facile in the extreme. But just finally on this, we've been talking about money. I was really encouraged by the previous set of speakers who were talking about the other resources into enterprise. And I repeatedly say to some of my colleagues in government, look, let's actually talk about labour markets. Let's actually talk about managerial labour, because it seems to me at least as big a problem for us in the UK is getting highly skilled managers in their mid-careers to be prepared to take the risk of growing high-potential companies. And we far too often replace it by a policy that tries to start more companies by growing our existing set of businesses. Clearly, finance is needed there, but managerial assets are at least as important in that. And that's what we should learn from the Americans in California.
Just make one comment. I think the contrast you made to the resource sector is a very interesting one. And I just make the point that Canada has very strong and real comparative advantage in the resource sector. We have the resources, we've developed expertise, and you know, we didn't develop a resource sector because we developed the financing angle first and then the resource sector came. We finance them because we're good at it, and we have a big established industry. I question whether we have comparative advantage in many areas of high technology or where these startups tend to be concentrated.
All right, thank you. We could turn to the audience for a question. I think there's one in the back. If you want to grab a mic. Okay.
Our panel was doing the same. But I guess one of my hypotheses is that in Canada, our governments are having to getting into it because they need to fix a situation that was caused by some of our regulatory and policy issues over the years. If we had VCs that were investing here in the 90s, well, guess what? They found out as they started to get liquid on those investments that we actually taxed cross-border transactions. Now, the worst thing you can do to an investor that's in a tax-free status is to actually tell him after he's exited his business, he's being taxed. And I don't know if anybody here has ever talked to an investor that got stuck with the 116 certificates and in terms of trying to exit their transactions with 116s. So we actually created a situation where foreign capital didn't want to come into the country. Now, we're fixing, I think, all of those issues, but my premise right now is that the government's got to do something, actually, to help to catalyze or at least promote the fact that our market conditions are flat again and are on our level playing field on an international stage.
I guess if your point
publicize, if your point is that the government should publicize the ongoing elimination of barriers to cross-border investment and finance flows, I agree with you. I think it slowly is becoming more widely known.
Just a very quick comment. Australia had exactly the same problem. It had a system where essentially if you were a foreign limited partner, you basically were caught by tax, double taxation, and essentially the LPs said to the Canberra government, if you want us to have the slightest interest in the other side of the world, you have to change that immediately. And it just raises one point. This is a really complicated area, and governments need to get informed when they intervene. Otherwise, they intervene badly. And it's not just about venture capital. It's about the legal structures. It's about the IP structures. It's about the tax structures. And what always frustrates me is that we actually see examples of good practice and bad practice across the world. And we seem almost incapable of learning and putting that into effect. Venture capitalists don't. They pick up ideas very, very rapidly globally. But governments tend not to do that. And that it is a source of constant frustration. But I will say one thing with the British government. The Treasury had a small business tax team, and it had a specialist group involved in venture capital, as did the, what was DTI, or we change our name every other week, what was the economics and business side. And you do need those specialists in government in order to understand what you guys say, in order to understand what your legitimate needs are. And government is all too often amateur at these kind of areas, and you cannot afford to be amateur in a rapidly globalizing world.
Better volunteer to answer the question. Any question from the audience that you'd like to ask our distinguished panel? Yes.
Well, just on the last one, how do governments avoid being amateurs? First of all, recognize that the previous governments, just because they were the opposition, may have had some good ideas. And those ideas should be continued. The worst thing you want is some pipsqueak of a new minister coming in saying, we're going to get rid of all of that. That was Labour or Tory or what have you. And in fairness, we've started to be a bit more mature, but many governments aren't. Secondly, to look at demand, to look at the quality of the businesses, the quality of the management, the quality of the technology, and to be honest with yourself. And this business about the role of Canada. We will not set up 100 world-class nanotechnology centres in 100 universities in the UK. Every vice-chancellor wants to do that. And the government has a role of being really quite tough and saying, we are going to concentrate our resources in areas where we stand a chance of being internationally and globally competitive. Now, that means telling a large proportion of your population that they're not going to get a slice of this cake. And very few governments are prepared to do that. Very few governments. You know, I know it's failing, but it is on the north side of a glacier, 300 miles above the Arctic Circle. It seems to be an economic argument in rather a lot of countries, except Australia.
You'll be glad to know that we have 12 securities commissions in Canada. So if one for each province, and I think there's one for the territories as well. So you're quite right. I just reflecting the frustrations from the time when I spent on the board of governors here at McGill, was that if we had a center of excellence, we had to have one in each province. Yeah. And in this province, because we have English and French, we have to have one in each language in the province, right? And this runs very deep. But politicians, let's face it, will never be able to run countercurrent to that. They will not swim up that stream. And so you can't rely on the political system to generate excellence, because immediately the envy of the neighboring constituency, the neighboring town, just creeps in and will destroy or render absolutely mediocre any excellence that happens to show up. So this is one of the dilemmas with hoping that governments can come around to things. I'm going to toss out an idea, not well thought through, so maybe this might stimulate. One of the things that always surprised me was the degree of participation in the project to try and get, to try and be able to launch vehicles into outer space and come back, the XPRIZE. One prize was given, and based on that, how many hundreds of millions were spent, how much was stimulated. Governments could actually probably have more fun with prizes, and there will be one winner, than to try and sit there and say, every town must have its center of excellence, every university must have its department of some obscure science or other, and to try and sit there and try and create a prize and see what comes out from people, rather than, as you say, try to micromanage how much of this kind of research we're going to do in that location for this type of entrepreneur. The prize approach has some, I won't say it'll cover all disciplines, has some rather remarkable outcomes.
Just one quick comment.
I'm going to offer the prize.
Not today. Many of you might have heard Warren Buffett's famous quote that being a great investor means knowing the right side of a 60-40 proposition. And it always stuck with me because it means that Warren Buffett, with 80 years of experience and a terrific track record, considers that he'll be wrong 40% of the time. And when you take a group of people, you know, with compromised motives, and when I say compromised, they're not just focused on making money. You know, someone, for a policy reason, has decided that this university should develop a nanotechnology center, or this country or this city should have an industry focused on this activity, you're going to be wrong way more than 40% of the time. And I just think the odds are so stacked against you that as a country with finite resources, is it smart for us to be allocating capital to it?
Can I make a comment before you become totally suicidal? We are actually starting to understand a lot about the financing, the other sides of the fiscal role. There's a lot of good quality research, and I criticize many of my colleagues, with honorable exceptions here, about the very poor role that universities have had in this debate. They do the research, they write it in papers, and they never talk to anyone who's important. And that's stupid. That's changing. What is really changing? Partly the culture, things like the Dragon's Den, Alan Sugar, has had a material influence. It really has had a material influence. We also know that if you study long-term startups, probably the single biggest key determinant of survival and success is human capital. And most people starting businesses traditionally are stupid, and they die quickly. Sorry, but it's true. Of the 400,000 businesses that start up in the UK every year, at least half of them shouldn't start up. They don't add any value. They cause a lot of pain and so on. But what you're seeing at the universities in the science base and among the undergraduates is a real interest in enterprise, and partly because there are no jobs. So what we're seeing, I teach in a university which we call a Green Welly University. I teach the sons and daughters of professional men and women. They're middle class, they're bright, they're keen, and they expect to do well. And for the first time in a generation, they will not walk into jobs as graduates. They aren't going to roll over and die at 22, 23, 24. And I see a real interest. Now, I don't want all of them becoming entrepreneurs. That would be absolutely disastrous. But I do see a real interest in young men and women actually looking at this as a real and viable alternative. And I do see more resources put into the universities, into the advisory system by government in the last 10 years to some effect. So we are actually starting to see in the science base as well some real positive activities. So not all investment in venture capital is disastrous. There are some excellent venture capitalists investing in excellent businesses in Cambridge, London, and elsewhere. But we just have to be very careful that we do not believe our own rhetoric, and we actually
realize that in some areas like this, we must discriminate. We must discriminate to the best, the brightest, the keenest, the most committed, and not just say everyone is equal, because that way we'll just waste tax dollars.
Thank you. There's, I'm getting signal that time is running out. I saw two hands that came up. Can we pick two questions quickly? The gentleman here, the one on the left had it.
You've already had your question.
All right. So one last question, I guess.
Okay, and I can't promise it's going to be all that short either, but Gordon, I want to thank you for lifting a little bit more inspiration into the room. This has been a bit of a dismal morning from my particular perspective. We've heard that the R&D that's been funded to the universities goes nowhere. We've heard that our educational models for producing entrepreneurs are pretty misguided, and we're getting a lot of sense that the only inspiration we should be looking at is south of the border. Let me follow what Gordon's doing just a little bit and say, yeah, you know, the theme is undoubtedly correct. We've got a lot of problems here, but let's look at the glass a little half full in places too. True, Canada has dropped off in these rankings that were mentioned this morning, but we're still number 10. Really, there's 250 countries below us. We're not doing all that badly. We were number 3 in 2002. We dropped to 14. We're back to 10. That's not so bad. In terms of the idea of getting R&D from the universities out to companies in a successful, commercializable way, I'll just give one quick anecdote. I'm from the University of Waterloo, and many of those companies that Doug represents and knows are companies that got their start with the R&D and the support from doctoral students and the credits they got from the government. And these are very well-known companies. DALSA, Research in Motion, Descartes, Comdev. These are successful companies, a lot of which got that funding. On the last part, too, about entrepreneurship education, it's, I think, true, very much what Gordon is saying, that they're not alone in the UK. Our colleague Teresa Menzies at Brock University has indicated over the last 4 or 5 years, we've had a tenfold increase in entrepreneurship-related education in the country. A few of us have different programs. I'll represent one where we only allow entrepreneurs into the program and provide that set of business skills that allow the commercialization factors that Doug so eloquently talked about to be mastered, to be nurtured, and to turn these into companies. The big problem we're finding, as Gen was mentioned at the table, and there's some people that represent here today, young entrepreneurs who cannot get access to that angel money. Venture capital to us is simply a theoretical concept. We need angel funding and need it badly. And finally, I'll just close on, that's not a question, you can tell that by now. I'm just going to close on this market mechanism. I was once a great fan of Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman, but I'll tell you, the last few years of what we've seen in the USA, and unless you've been on a different planet, you've seen the same kind of thing, that is not necessarily the model that we need to emulate here in this country. We have solutions to it. We're not doing as badly as I think we're hearing here this morning. I would love to return to the three questions that Doug raised earlier this morning. We have an issue. We have a declaration in front of us that have got some ways in which we can improve. There's some wonderful suggestions here for moving our country forward to being one of the innovative leaders. I'd love to see us concentrate on a few of these a little bit later. Thank you for your indulgence.
So we, at the beginning, we suggested we would have a two-minute wrap-up discussion, but I think I'm getting yanked back by my esteemed professor. So I think that we'll conclude the panel with this, and I invite you to join us for lunch, and the panelists will join us, and I invite you to follow up with questions and remarks as we eat. Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you, Jerome. And just before we break for lunch, yes, it does sound dismal. And I hope that later on in the afternoon, as you're sitting there hearing the problems, that perhaps you're thinking about how can we fix it. And that's something I'd like to return to later on. And after the next panel, we'll have an open discussion and we'll have some table discussions about what are some of the best ways we can figure out in going forward to fix some of these issues. Before then, let me thank our panelists. Jerome, I know that you are incredibly busy these days, and your time is valuable. Richard, I know many entrepreneurs who would give their right leg for the time you've given us. Gordon, guesting from the UK, came over, flew over here for the seminar, and delighted he did. And Ian Peters, who's seen it from both sides, and his advice today, I think, is extremely instructive. Thank you to the four of you. We'll break for lunch and reconvene. We'll try to be on time.